Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we continue our 30 Issues election series with Issue 17. The United States is, or isn't, heading for a debt crisis. It's kind of remarkable, really, for the issue that might be the most central to gridlock in Washington. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both barely mention it. The last time the federal government had a surplus in any year was when Bill Clinton was president.
People ask me all the time how we got four surplus budgets in a row. What new ideas did we bring to Washington? I always give a one-word answer. Arithmetic.
Ha, that was Clinton speaking at the 2012 Democratic Convention. But if that one-word answer, arithmetic, seems like common sense, just add politics to your equation and add some spending programs you think are important to the country, and you might get a different result. Here is President Reagan on the rising debt during his presidency when he was spending a lot on a big military buildup.
Let me say what the defense debate is not about. It is not about spending arithmetic. I know that in the last few weeks you've been bombarded with numbers and percentages. Some say we need only a 5% increase in defense spending. The so-called alternate budget, backed by liberals in the House of Representatives, would lower the figure to 2 to 3%, cutting our defense spending by $163 billion over the next 5 years. The trouble with all these numbers is that they tell us little about the kind of defense program America needs or the benefits in security and freedom that our defense effort buys for us.
President Reagan in 1983, you figure out what the country needs and then worry about the arithmetic. Just 2 years earlier, though, he had told a joint session of Congress that he was really worried about the national debt.
Can we who man the ship of state deny it is somewhat out of control? Our national debt is approaching $1 trillion. A few weeks ago, I called such a figure, $1 trillion, incomprehensible. And I've been trying ever since to think of a way to illustrate how big a trillion really is. And the best I could come up with is that if you had a stack of $1,000 bills in your hand, only 4 inches high, you'd be a millionaire. $1 trillion would be a stack of $1,000 bills 67 miles high. The interest on the public debt this year we know will be over $90 billion. And unless we change the proposed spending for the fiscal year beginning October 1st, we'll add another almost $80 billion to the debt.
A trillion here, a trillion there. Soon you're talking real money, at least in 1981 dollars. He nailed the issue, by the way. The problem with the national debt is the interest we have to pay. Think of your own budget. If your student loans are so big, you pay 75% of your income to the bank every month. You don't have much left for food and childcare and medical expenses and whatever else, not to mention going out and having fun. Now, governments don't go out and have fun, but still, if the accumulated debt gets too big, so many of our annual tax dollars go to paying the interest on bonds that all the other important things get squeezed: education, healthcare, defense, you name it. But how much is too much? Politicians have fought about that for generations.
If we assume the debts the union gets, a new line of credit, a financial diuretic, how do you not get it? If we're aggressive and competitive, the union gets a boost. You'd rather give it a sedative.
That's Cabinet Battle Number 1 from the Hamilton soundtrack. Hamilton, America's first Treasury Secretary, saw the very first federal deficits as a means to economic growth and international power. He also established the Bank of the United States, a precursor to the Federal Reserve, to loan the government money. Thomas Jefferson saw the Bank of the United States as a scheme to help the rich get richer. Sound familiar? How much debt for what public purpose has remained a political issue ever since. In the 1960 presidential debates, John F. Kennedy argued for not reducing the national debt.
I did not advocate reducing the federal debt because I don't believe that you're going to be able to reduce the federal debt very much in 1961, 2, or 3. I think you have heavy obligations which affect our security, which we're going to have to meet. And therefore, I've never suggested we should be able to retire the debt substantially or even at all in 1961
Senator,
or two.
I believe.
National security was one reason at the height of the Cold War. He also wanted to borrow to give public school teachers a raise. Imagine that in today's politics. And to create Medicare, which didn't yet exist.
Medical care for the aged, I would put under Social Security. The Vice President and I disagree on this. Secondly, I support federal aid to education and federal aid for teacher salaries. I think that's a good investment. I think we're going to have to do it. And I think to heap the burden further on the property tax, which is already strained in many of our communities, will ensure, in my opinion, that many of our children will not be adequately educated and many of our teachers not adequately compensated. There is no greater return to an economy or to a society than an educational system second to none.
How interesting that way back in 1960, they were already concerned about the increase in local property taxes to pay for education. Richard Nixon's comeback in that debate was to oppose the creation of Medicare as too expensive.
It should be pointed out that, of course, it is not possible, particularly under the proposals that Senator Kennedy has advocated, either to cut the national debt or to reduce taxes. As a matter of fact, it will be necessary to raise taxes. As Senator Kennedy points out, that as far as his one proposal is concerned, the one for medical care for the aged, that would be financed out of Social Security. That, however, is raising taxes for those who pay Social Security.
Shortly thereafter, Nixon continued.
If he unbalances the budget, that means you have inflation, and that will be, of course, a very cruel blow to the very people, the older people that we've been talking about. As far as aid for school construction is concerned, I favor that, as Senator Kennedy did in January of this year, when he said he favored that rather than aid to teacher salaries. I favor that because I believe that's the best way to aid our schools without running any risk whatever of the federal government telling our teachers what to teach.
Nixon and Kennedy from the first ever televised presidential debate on September 26, 1960. Remember Bill Clinton boasting about those four consecutive balanced budgets, 1997 to 2000? In fairness, Newt Gingrich and his Republican allies in the House did a lot to push Clinton into it. We will get to Gingrich in just a minute. Forgive me, I skipped over one of the clips. In 1965, 5 years after that Nixon-Kennedy debate, LBJ was president, and he was trying to spend a lot of federal money on both his Great Society programs, including Medicare, which he had then created, and the Vietnam War. And he was asked this by a reporter.
What you have outlined as your program for now, it would seem that you feel that we can have guns and butter for the foreseeable future. Do you have any idea right now, though, that down the road a piece, the American people may have to face the problem of guns or butter?
I have not the slightest doubt, but whatever it's necessary to face, the American people will face. I think that all of us know that we are now in the 52nd month of the prosperity that's been unequaled in this nation. And I see no reason for declaring a national emergency, and I rejected that course of action earlier today when I made my decision. I cannot foresee what next year or the following year will hold. I only know that the Americans will do whatever is necessary, and at the moment we enjoy the good fortune of having an unparalleled period of prosperity with us, and this government's going to do all it can to see it continued.
An unparalleled period of prosperity in the mid-60s, allowing LBJ to build up the troop strength in Vietnam and start Medicare and Medicaid and other programs without worrying about the national debt. Now back to the Clinton years and Clinton boasting about those four consecutive balanced budgets, 1997 to 2000. In fairness, Newt Gingrich and his Republican allies in the House did a lot to push Clinton into it. In 1994, the year the Republicans won a majority in the House for the first time in 40 years, Gingrich campaigned on his contract with America, which included a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution.
Now, you can ask us, how will we take this huge, out-of-balance, enormous federal budget, and how will we change it? Let me surprise all of you by quoting from the greatest president of the 20th century, who stood in this city on March 4th, 1933, in the middle of a Great Depression, standing in braces at a time when it was inconceivable that a man in a wheelchair could lead a great nation. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself. And I would say to all of you, if we truly reach out, not just for the first 100 days, but if we Republicans are prepared to reach out to the American people again and again and again, if we're prepared to have town hall meetings and invite every citizen to come with their ideas for cutting spending, if we're prepared to go out to the information revolution and find every method for downsizing, if we will approach the challenge of getting to a balanced budget with the standpoint that we have nothing to fear but fear itself, we'll get there.
Gingrich in 94. Now, the balanced budget amendment never got off the ground as a change to the Constitution, but it did as a matter of politics and economics during the boom of the late 90s, which helped produce enough tax revenue that those four balanced budgets were easier than they might have been. But then in 2000 came the bursting of the tech bubble, strike one, and the next year, 9/11, which hit the economy, strike two. Federal tax revenue took that double hit. And President George W. Bush, newly elected, also wanted a big new income tax cut. He got it while starting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Strike three. The national debt started to skyrocket again. By 2008, when Bush was leaving office, presidential candidate Barack Obama ran against the Bush deficits and even called them unpatriotic.
The problem is that the way Bush has done it over the last 8 years is to take out a credit card from the Bank of China in the name of our children, driving up our national debt from $5 trillion for the first 42 presidents. Number 43 added $4 trillion by his lonesome, so that we now have over $9 trillion of debt that we are going to have to pay back. $30,000 for every man, woman, and child. That's irresponsible. It's unpatriotic.
Obama in 08, pretty different from Obama in 2012, when he got criticized for running up the debt with his Keynesian response to the financial crisis.
We don't have to worry about it short term. Right now, interest rates are low because people still consider the United States the safest and greatest country on earth, rightfully so. But it is a problem long term, mm-hmm, and even medium term. And so we're going to have to take care of this debt and this deficit, but we've got to do it in a balanced way.
Obama on David Letterman during his 2012 reelection campaign. And when he was reelected, the Republican House pushed the debt issue hard. The next year, 2013, saw one partial government shutdown over the issue of government spending for the first time since Gingrich was Speaker, an actual government shutdown led by Ted Cruz, and almost saw another over raising the debt ceiling to pay back our incurred debts. The federal government even had its S&P credit rating downgraded because Cruz and the Tea Party seemed serious. Obama pushed back.
Members of Congress and the House Republicans in particular don't get to demand ransom in exchange for doing their jobs. And two of their very basic jobs are passing a budget and making sure that America's paying its bills. They don't also get to say, you know, unless you give me what the voters rejected in the last election, I'm going to cause a recession. That's not how it works.
So that was 2013. The Republicans got a lot of bad press for the shutdown and debt ceiling debacle, but then racked up big wins in the 2014 midterm elections, expanding their majority in the House and winning control of the Senate. There was a popular base for what they did. And yet neither Clinton nor Trump are running on the debt. We'll talk to two guests now. In a few minutes, Mark Zandi from Moody's Analytics, who's been comparing Clinton and Trump's economic plans. And first, with an eye on the history clips we just played, as well as the present, none other than Alan Simpson, Republican senator from Wyoming from 1979 to 1997, co-chair with Democrat Erskine Bowles of the Simpson-Bowles Fiscal Responsibility and Reform Commission in 2010. And as some of you astute listeners know, a guy who helped Anna Sale, host of our Death, Sex, and Money podcast, figure out what to do with her Wyoming boyfriend. Spoiler alert, they're now married and recently had their first child. Hi, Senator Simpson. Welcome back to WNYC.
What a pleasure, and what a wonderful, thoughtful review of things. That was, you're doing an educational process there that is good. It's cheaper than Hamilton, but good. I'll tell you, that's terrific. Really, I was very impressed by that.
It's all true. Really glad you enjoyed it and vouch for it. By the way, after your touching and hilarious role in Anna's podcast, did you go to the wedding?
Oh, yeah. Not only that, we hosted the reception, the bridal, after the rehearsal. And I read the original email that he wrote me. I don't remember him at all. And I read it. He said, "You're not going to read that." I said, "Yeah, this is called taking a risk in life. And you took a big one, pal." And so we hosted that. Her family, his family, we're at the wedding. The dog howled. We were outside. Oh, it was big stuff, I'll tell you. A lot of fun.
And
they live just two doors away, and he's headed for Berkeley as a professor. And her program, they said, "Anna, you can move anywhere. You're the best." So she's headed out there with him, and this beautiful little girl, June Sale, was at a function last night, attached to her mother, I might add, quite attached. I mean, you couldn't get any more attached. 2 months old. Wonderful to see.
Wait, they gave her the mother's last name?
The mother, Anna Sale, and the child's name is June Sale.
There you go. A matriarch, matrilineal, I guess. our Anna Sale, whose Death, Sex, and Money podcast will continue. Well, she'll always be fond of you for your relationship advice and, I guess, your ongoing relationship. I joked with her, well, maybe you'll ask Mitch McConnell for parenting tips. But...
I don't think you get far there, but she has high regard for you. And last night we were together, as I say, at a function with Arthur. I said, "I got to get to bed. I got to get up and do a little with Brian Lehrer." She said, "What?" He's somebody I worked with and enjoyed so much, and she's very high on you. But anyway,
Thank you. You're talking
big tough. You're talking stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And she said it wouldn't be the same going to another senator for personal advice. Anyway, any thoughts on the debt in the big sweep of history from Alexander Hamilton to the present?
I had the joy and pleasure, Ann and I, to see Hamilton a few weeks ago. Man, I love that, because that has to be, you know, young people don't pay any attention to history. They don't even teach it in some places. That play and things you do in this, that educates people to the tremendous responsibility of doing something with a debt. Now, don't forget, the only part you left off is that Obama took it from $11 trillion to $19
billion.
I mean, you know, let's get serious. You don't forget who did it. This is the greatest blame game in the world, is America right now, or how to pick a scab and get into it and go back. And the issue is not how we got there. It's what do we do now? And debt is on automatic pilot. It's unstoppable right now unless you do things with the biggest items in the budget, which is health care, and not be nasty and call it Obamacare. Health care and the solvency of Social Security, and nobody's touching it with a stick.
Let me play one more history clip and see what you think about it in the light of current events. In the 80s, as you know, since you were in the Senate, there was already a deal necessary to shore up Social Security. But here's something Ronald Reagan said at the time in one of the presidential debates with Walter Mondale in 1984.
Social Security has nothing to do with the deficit. Social Security is totally funded by the payroll tax levied on employer and employee. If you reduce the outgo of Social Security, that money would not go into the general fund to reduce a deficit. It would go into the Social Security Trust Fund. So Social Security has nothing to do with balancing a budget or erasing or lowering the deficit.
Huh. Did you agree with President Reagan then, and do you today?
Well, all I can say is read the trustees' report. A new one just came out. These are thoughtful Republicans and Democrats. Call the Social Security trustees, and they're saying by doing nothing, in the year 2034, you're going to waddle up to the window and get a check for 21% less. And don't bother with what that thing you got in the mail which says schedule benefits, because the law, well, FDR was pretty cute. You put in there that there's no schedule benefits, you get the payable benefit. And anybody that pretends, and then they stole a trust fund. Give me a break. The law provided that it got to $2.5 trillion or $3 trillion. That's true, but you put in gold-edged treasuries, and you take it out to build things and do things, and then when you need the money, you put in the gold treasury, and you pull out the money, and we started to do that when we were working the issue in 2010. That started, and now this baby is about $900 billion in deficit.
If we just funded Social Security out of the Social Security tax that President Reagan referred to there. He said that's why it has nothing to do with the national debt. It's its own closed system. There's a special Social Security tax, and that pays for Social Security. If it never was raided to pay for other government functions, would there be a Social Security debt bomb sitting there, in your opinion?
No, but don't forget, we really only raided it once, and I think it was in Johnson's administration where it was a raid. The others are not raids. They're putting in, except it doesn't appear as a budget transaction, they put in these things into the gold treasuries and pull it out, use the money, and then when I need the money, but there isn't. Look, when I was drinking beer at the University of Wyoming, there were 16 people paying into this system and one taken out. Today, there are three people paying in and one taken out. This baby was set up when you died at 63 and you retired at 65. That's a pretty good way to set up something. And now the average age is 80 and you can still retire at 62. I heard the part earlier, try arithmetic, try math. Bill Clinton's absolutely correct. Try it on Social Security and bring tears to your eyes.
When your Simpson-Bowles debt report came out in 2010, it got criticized by people like Paul Krugman from the left for being too stingy with Social Security and Medicare, and from people like Paul Ryan on the right for being too big government in its solutions. And sure enough, Congress was too polarized, as you well know, to do anything with it. How much do you think there is a ticking time bomb, I guess you made that clear with your last answer, called the national debt, and how much do you think a consensus is possible about what to do about it?
It's impossible. I love it. Erskine is one of the greatest guys I've ever worked with, and he was the guy under Clinton, chief of staff, who balanced the budget. Don't forget who did that. That was Erskine. People come up to us. It's a joy to watch. They clutch at your clothing, and they say, love what you did, except for that one part. And they'll jab your eyeballs out with a stick if you touch that part. Let me tell you, you can't. And the tax code, when you hear a guy moan and bitch about 47% of people don't pay taxes, just remember the tax code has about 200 things in it, and only 20% of the American people use 80% of the stuff in the tax code, and it costs over $1 trillion a year.
You mean so you wanted to raise some taxes and you wanted to lower some spending, and depending on whether the person was coming at you from the left or the right, that one thing or the other was a deal breaker.
I tell you, the thing that was great, people will say, well, who voted for this turkey? Well, it's a 67-page report in English, uses words like going broke and shared sacrifice, which nobody can understand. And they said, well, who voted for it? Well, I said, Dick Durbin. Dick Durbin, that commie from Illinois. Well, Tom Coburn, that Republican guy from Oklahoma, let me tell you, our purpose.
Senator Alan Simpson, former Senator Alan Simpson, with us for just another minute or so here on WNYC in our 30 Issues election series, looking at the debt, issue 17. And before you go, I can't resist but to ask your thoughts about Donald Trump. Since you're a retired Republican senator, on a scale from intrigued to horrified at the prospect of him as president, where would you place yourself?
I have to go to the bathroom.
You and Paul Ryan.
I stay out of. I can't. I can define them all four of them. You know, Bernie, Hillary, you know, the whole works, but it's a difficult thing, and our party is being hammered. And of course, Republicans, I've been with them 84 years. I voted for Ike in 20, and Republicans always give each other the saliva test of purity, and then they lose, and then they bitch for 4 years, and boy, are they headed for that.
But many people say he's not a normal candidate. He refused to endorse Paul Ryan for re-election yesterday. Did you see that?
I did. We never know what the Donald is up to, and we just glue ourselves to 24/7, and that's half of what's got America absolutely confounded. Who's going to wear a orange jumpsuit? Who's going to go to the clink? Who's going to have a hearing? And meanwhile, the ship of state is careening along with nobody dealing with two-thirds of the American budget, and that's pretty sad. And then they can't do a budget, because if they try one, then they'll get ripped to shreds by, particularly by the AARP. If any of you out there are members of the AARP, that's about 38 million Americans bound together by a common love of airline discounts and all sorts of things and erectile dysfunction ads. It's most amazing, and they don't give a whit about their grandchildren, and they are absolutely the most irresponsible group in the world today. And senior citizens, boy, you don't mess with them. Hell, I've been on Social Security since I was 15, put in $5. I never put in over $800 when I practiced law for 18 years. Now they come in and say, I'll get it all back. Well, you got it all back in the first 4 years if you're my age, period.
Well, nice way to bring it back to the debt. But you don't want to take a stand on President Obama's call yesterday for Republicans to say, look, Donald Trump is just not qualified to be president.
Yeah, but watch out, because the more that Obama gets nasty, or Hillary, or anybody else, or the New York Times, or the Post, or what people see as the libs, the more that helps Trump. Watch out.
If the Republicans don't, in fact, join them.
Alan Simpson. That's right, but watch out.
What a pleasure. Thank you very much for giving us this time.
Thank you very much.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. It's our 30 Issues election series, Issue 17. There is, or isn't, a ticking time bomb in the national debt. Maybe you saw Thomas Friedman's New York Times column today admonishing the candidates for not talking about economic growth. He supports Hillary Clinton, but derided her for the socialism light, as he called it, in her economic plans, as reflected by this list of spending items in her Democratic Convention acceptance speech.
In my first 100 days, we will work with both parties to pass the biggest investment in new good-paying jobs since World War II. Jobs in manufacturing, clean energy, technology and innovation, small business and infrastructure. If we invest in infrastructure now, we'll not only create jobs today, but lay the foundation for the jobs of the future. And we will also transform the way we prepare our young people for those jobs. Bernie Sanders and I will work together to make college tuition free for the middle class and debt free for all. We will also liberate millions of people who already have student debt.
Clinton in Philadelphia. For his part, Trump doesn't get specific about almost anything regarding economic growth, but he has taken a lot of heat for this muse about how he might reduce the national debt.
If we can buy back government debt at a discount, in other words, if interest rates go up and we can buy bonds back at a discount, if we are liquid enough as a country, we should do that. In other words, we can buy back debt at a discount. People said, I want to go and buy debt and default on debt. These people are crazy. This is the United States government. First of all, you never have to default because you print the money. I hate to tell you, okay? So there's never a default. You know, I'm the king of debt. I understand debt better than probably anybody. I know how to deal with debt so very well. I love debt, but you know, debt is tricky and it's dangerous, and you have to be careful and you have to know what you're doing.
Lower the interest rate on some treasury bonds. So is the debt a ticking time bomb? And which candidate's finger do we want on the debt bomb button? With us now to compare Trump and Clinton on this issue is Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody's Analytics, which last week issued a report on the Clinton economic plan, which they said would increase the debt in the short term, but maybe not the long term because it could spur economic growth. Zandi, according to what I've read, and he'll confirm it for us, advised John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign, but has also donated to the Clinton campaign. Three other Moody's economists also worked on this report. Mark, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And first, for full disclosure, what's your relationship to the Clinton campaign and your own description of any vested interest you have in this analysis?
Well, I'm a D. I'm a registered Democrat, always have been. I did contribute to the Clinton campaign in the primary. That's the extent of the relationship. And as you pointed out in the introduction, I have participated in Republican campaigns as an economic advisor, and I've contributed to R. So I've been on both sides.
And in this analysis, you're trying to do a down-the-middle objective look, not trying to help a candidate or another candidate?
Yeah, that's the idea. You know, the Congressional Budget Office, that's the nonpartisan agency that evaluates legislation and tries to determine what the impact that has on the economy and on the budget, the federal budget. That's the same kind of approach methodology that we took with our studies on Mr. Trump and Secretary Clinton.
So a number of articles have been written now, you've probably seen them, on how liberal, or Thomas Friedman calls it socialist light, that list of Clinton-Sanders economic proposals is, that are now in her platform and her acceptance speech. Is that what you're basically analyzing in terms of debt and economic growth impact?
Well, in the case of Secretary Clinton, we evaluated three key policies. One was her tax and spending policies, which you just articulated. Second was her immigration policy. She's a strong advocate of immigration reform. And third, her proposals on minimum wage. So those are the three key economic policies that we considered in that analysis.
Want to give us some numbers?
Yeah. So if we take it at face value, meaning we take exactly what she says she wants, and in fact, the Clinton campaign is quite transparent with regard to that. If you go to their website, lays it out pretty clearly. In fact, in our papers, both on Trump and Clinton, we have hyperlinks to, you know, precisely where we get our assumptions. But if you take it at face value, and just that means that there's no political fetters here. You know, we're assuming that what she wants, she gets. It goes through Congress, and of course, that's not going to happen. But just to give it a sense of what it all means, the economy, as measured by GDP, jobs, is somewhat stronger under her policies over the next, well, 4 years, her term, and we also consider the economy over the next 10 years, assuming her policies continue to move forward, than it would be if there was no change in law, if we used current policy. That's our baseline.
Conservative economists would say that all the spending that we heard her list in that clip should add a lot to the debt and slow growth in the private sector, because it would overregulate the private sector in the name of economic fairness. Sounds like you don't buy that argument all that much.
No, I would, except that she pays for her spending proposals by raising taxes on high-income, high-net-worth households, generating revenue by raising taxes on the financial system.
Which conservative economists would say also depresses economic growth, because with higher taxes, they have less incentive to invest.
And I would agree with that as well, if you take it by itself, yeah. And in fact, if you take her tax spending policies together, I don't think that's a big plus or negative for the economy over her president, her next, over her term, over the next 10 years. That's, it, you know, depending on the timing, it's a positive near term, it's a negative longer term, net, it's a wash. So that's not where you get the added economic growth, at least not over the next 10 years.
I don't know if you heard Alan Simpson in our previous segment, who's pretty much a deficit hawk. He's really afraid what the accumulating national debt is going to do to our children, how it's going to squeeze our ability to spend on education and almost anything but debt service and the senior citizens' entitlements that we're borrowing to pay for. But what's your general take as an economist on how big any potential debt bomb in America's future is?
I think it's a problem. I don't think it's existential, at least not in the immediate future. I mean, if you take the Congressional Budget Office projections for the economy and interest rates, and they all seem pretty reasonable to me, probably because they're pretty close to my projections. You know, the deficits will be about 3% of GDP through the remainder of the decade. The nation's debt-to-GDP ratio will rise, but it'll be manageable. I mean, you know, if I were king for the day, I certainly would do things differently and work to reduce debt, because I agree with Senator Simpson's perspective. I sympathize with it. But I don't think it's an existential issue now. And long run, you know, the real problem and the thing that we really need to, if we're going to address our fiscal issues, our debt problem long run, meaning next decade, the decade after, it's about addressing the growth in healthcare costs, because it's really the cost of Medicare and Medicaid that break the bank, that cause the deficit and debt to rise. And that, of course, means we got to take another crack at the at healthcare reform, the healthcare system. And I don't think we're in a position to do that, you know, in the immediate future. But, you know, later in the decade, early in the next, I think we're going to have to take another crack at it. That's the way we're going to solve this problem.
So, listeners, we've been talking about the national debt as an issue or a non-issue in the presidential campaign. Maybe it's a non-issue that should be an issue, with Alan Simpson and the clips we played from U.S. history over the last 50 years or so, plus a clip from Hamilton, and now Mark Zandi. And if you have a phone call with a comment or a question in our remaining few minutes on this, you can call up right now at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody's Analytics, as we compare Clinton and Trump. And on to Donald Trump, in the clip we played, he talks about how he, as a business owner, has restructured debt when his companies have gotten into too much debt. That's part of what the corporate bankruptcy laws let you do. Is that an applicable model, as he suggests, to any degree for the federal government?
No. There's no restructuring U.S. government debt. I mean, you know, we're money good. We're the AAA credit, and that buys us enormous economic benefit. And, in fact, that was the one of the most beautiful things Alexander Hamilton did, right? I mean, if you remember back to the Revolution and the script that was issued to pay for the Revolution, he honored that debt, even though, of course, the U.S. was in dire financial straits. And by doing so, he established the AAA credit worthiness of our country. That's why rates are low. That's why we can borrow so cheaply, and really why the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency. And that just is, you can't underestimate how important that is to our economy and to our future. So, no, there's no restructuring our debt. Our debt we pay, and we pay in a timely way. And if, as long as everyone knows that and understands that, we're good.
And would there be, I mean, his harshest critics, who may be right, you don't have to play this down the middle if the answer isn't down the middle. His harshest critics have said that would be actually an unbelievable threat to our economy, because the full faith and credit of the United States government to pay the interest on our treasury bonds is, I guess, what we're talking about, is so much the basis of stability in the U.S. economy and the world economy, that what he was saying there was really crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what he was saying. I can't discern what he was saying. So, you know, I can't believe that he actually thought about this for, you know, more than 3 seconds, that he'd go down that path. So just leave it at that. That makes no sense. And because it makes no sense, we're just not going to do it.
Have you and your Moody's colleagues crunched Trump economic proposals in a similar way to what you were describing of your analysis of Clinton's?
Yes, we did that a few weeks ago, and you can find it on the web pretty easily. You know, you can Google and you'll find it. And again, you know, if you take his policies at face value, and in Mr. Trump's case, it's more difficult because he's less transparent. But the one thing that he is very transparent with regard to on his website is his tax spending policy. And if you take it at face value, you know, it's very large tax cuts for high-income, high-net-worth households. But there's really very little in spending cuts. So he does, under his proposal, run very large budget deficits, almost $1 trillion more than would otherwise be the case. And so over a 10-year period, again, that's the horizon of our analysis, it adds $9.5 trillion to the national debt. And by the way, that number is not just my number. That's Tax Policy Center, Tax Foundation, you know, everyone who's kind of looked at this, and you can look at the analysis and you can see it's quite rigorous, come up with the same result. So that is a large increase in the deficit and debt, and that will be a problem. That would result in higher interest rates.
And at least one of those groups is a conservative group, right? The Tax Foundation?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. That's right.
So what's he missing? Is he cutting taxes too much without cutting spending? Because he hasn't been a deficit hawk like Republicans who've come before him, or like Paul Ryan, I think we can fairly say is. So what's missing from the Trump plan that causes those deficits to balloon?
Well, there's no spending, comparable spending cuts to the tax cuts. And, you know, you can't, nothing's for free. I mean, if you're going to have tax cuts, that means you got to, you know, if you're going to have a, if it's going to be deficit neutral, if you're not going to add to your debt, you got to come up with spending cuts. And he just doesn't do that. Now, you know, I don't think he, I don't know for sure, but talking to his advisors, you know, they're smart people. They know that this isn't going to work. So my guess is they'll scale this back at some point, you know, make it more doable from an arithmetic perspective. They'll cut back some of those tax cuts that they currently have planned. That'd be my guess. You know, it feels more like a political document than an economic one. But of course, you know, that's how we're thinking, judging his policies. It's what he says. And mm-hmm. we're just trying to plug, you know, take it to its logical conclusion.
Arithmetically. All right. Let's take a few phone calls on the national debt as an issue. Bernard in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bernard.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to know if your guest has folded demographic considerations into his analyses. That is, I know that China is facing a demographic gun to its head because the skewing of its population in terms of age. What about the United States, and how might immigration policy affect that issue?
Yeah, great question, and you were right on point. Actually, the thing that really distinguishes the Trump proposals from the Clinton proposals on the economy and what it means for economic growth are their positions on immigration. So Mr. Trump is obviously no fan of immigration, has asked for the 11 million plus undocumented immigrants in the country to leave. Clinton is all in on immigration. She has endorsed the reform legislation that was passed by the Senate. You remember the Gang of Eight legislation. Senator Rubio was one of the Gang of Eight. That was actually scored by the Congressional Budget Office, and you know they calculated the economic and budget impacts of it. That, and our results are very similar to theirs. Oh, of course, in that legislation, the 11 million plus undocumented would have a path to at least legalization, and she's now advocating for a path to citizenship. That's a very clear difference, and I think they're both committed to that. So that feels more, you know, obviously there's a political angle to that, but I would imagine they are going to pursue those policies if one or the other became president. That leads to a very different place for the economy. Immigration, under the reform that was passed in 2013, would increase by 1 million per year. A lot of them would be skilled and educated. And that is huge because, you know, going forward, our biggest problem as a nation isn't going to be unemployment. It's going to be a lack of labor because the boomers are retiring en masse, and that's going to continue for the next 10, 15 years. And if we don't allow more immigrants into the country, the labor force is going to come to a virtual standstill a few years from now. So this is very, very important to economic growth.
But you said skilled labor. What Trump focuses on mostly is what he describes as a glut of unskilled labor coming across the southern border and depressing wages for the jobs that do exist in this country.
Yeah, I think going forward, that's not going to be an issue either. I think the unskilled labor we're going to need as well, that we're just not going to have the labor that we need, both at the very high end in terms of skills and education and at the very low end in terms of skills and education. And moreover, if you look at the immigrant that come to the country, they tend to be, and this again, this is not only me speaking, this is the Congressional Budget Office speaking, tend to be more innovative, entrepreneurial. Almost by definition, they're risk takers. You know, coming from one country to another is like, that's tough to do for an individual. And so they tend to start companies and innovate, and they're key to long-run productivity growth. And that's also part of the benefit of, you know, allowing for more immigrants into the country. So, one final thing. Mm-hmm. If you look at the undocumented, many of those people are skilled, but they can't use their talents because they are illegal and they're nervous and afraid and are taken advantage of in the labor market. And again, this isn't just me speaking. This is the Congressional Budget Office speaking, that if we allow them a path to at least legalization, you know, I can understand the concern about allowing for citizenship, but to legalization, then you unlock that potential. They'll take jobs that are more suited to their skill set, and we'll get a more productive economy and more GDP, more income. And it's very, very – by the way, this is very, very important to our long-run fiscal situation, because we're going to need those immigrants working to pay for the benefits that go to the boomers who are retiring and taking Social Security and Medicare and so forth and so on.
Tim in Baldwin, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I can't give you the exact number because I'm not at my desk, but the total income of the federal government is around $17 trillion, $15 trillion, $17 trillion, I don't remember the number. But half of it comes from
GDP, $17 trillion.
No, no, yeah. the tax take on the income tax of the federal government, what it takes in taxes.
Do you know roughly, Mark, total?
Yeah, I think it's a couple trillion per annum. $2 trillion, maybe you're thinking over a 10-year period. $17 trillion mm-hmm. is the GDP of the nation.
But yeah. Tim, you're headed to a point about who pays Social Security taxes, right?
I'm getting to the point of how we fund the government and how underfunded it is. Whatever the take is for the federal government, I don't have the number in front of me anymore. But whatever the take is, about half of it is paid for by the top, at most 5th percentile. I think it's 2. We know from past experience with those incomes, that they pay between 15 and 12% on their incomes, on their total incomes. If they were taxed the way I'm taxed, the federal take would double, so we could cover Social Security, health care benefits, all of the things that are so severely underfunded, infrastructure, education. I mean, and that's only if they pay what I pay. If they paid a proportional tax, a just proportional tax, I would say when you start making $5 million, you should be paying at least 50%.
Tim, thank you very much. Do you take a position on at least how to balance the budget and how to avoid the deficits that Social Security and Medicare will produce?
I think the caller makes a good point. And actually, that's kind of the basis for the Clinton plan, when you think about it.
Right.
I mean, she's raising marginal rates on very high-income households with a lot of net worth. You know, the estate, she raises the estate tax and so forth and so on. So she's using that revenue. But instead of using that to pay down the debt, you know, to reduce deficits and pay down the debt, what she's doing is she's taking that money and saying, okay, I'm going to increase spending on other things that I think are important to the population and the economy. You know, infrastructure, she mentions, education, you know, free college for people who make less than a certain income, paid family leave. Those are the kinds of things that she's focused on. So, you know, that's one way of going about it. But it is important to note that that doesn't solve, even if you were going to raise the effective rate on high-income households to something comparable to the average. And by the way, the average effective tax rate, federal tax rate, is 15%. So if you just kind of make sure everyone got there, then it's still not going to solve all our long-term problems. We're still going to have that real debt problem out 10, 20 years from now.
One more call. Joe in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
Two things. One is, in terms of your guest's comments about immigration, Branko Milanovic, in his recent book, would query his assumptions, in particular the fact that uncontrolled or semi-uncontrolled immigration does have very negative impacts in terms of income inequality for low-skilled, unskilled, native-born populations, not only in the United States, but in the world in general. But my original comment was, isn't the real problem with the American economy and the fiscal issue is the fact that since 2001, we've had a significant decline in both productivity and growth, and the history of the U.S. in the second half of the 20th century, both in the Clinton as well as the 75 period, was that even with very large deficits, or in terms of GDP ratios, high growth.
Right.
Growth
rate. Joe, thank you. I'm going to leave it there. And we've got a minute left in the segment. Let's leave the immigration debate for another day. We'll keep having that on this show. But with respect to growth, and we just had a terrible growth report for the last quarter last week, like 1% growth, a lot of people say, yeah, the big difference between America since 2000 and America before 2000 is that we could expect 3-4 something like that percent growth in the economy, and what a difference that would make if we were able to achieve it again, to outrunning the deficits caused by the aging of the population and all the other things we want to spend money on. But we only have this like 2% growth as a ceiling since the year 2000, basically. Is it realistic to expect a return to the 20th century no matter what policies we institute?
I think we can get stronger growth. Oh, by the way, federal government revenue over the last year through June was $3.3 trillion. So just to get that on the record, $3.3 trillion.
Baseline.
Yeah, but I think we can get stronger growth. I think there are three key policies that if we implement will make a difference in terms of growth over the next 4 years and over the long run. First is immigration reform. We need more immigrants, and that's a key difference why growth is slower today than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago, because the labor force is growing much more slowly today and will grow more slowly because of just our demographics, the aging of the boomers, and the fact that female participation rates are no longer rising because females are working at the same participation rate as everybody else. Second is corporate tax reform. I'm on board for all kinds of tax reform, but I focus on corporate because that's doable. You know, it's bipartisan, and I think there's a lot we can get that done. And three is infrastructure spending. I think that's a slam dunk, you know, in terms of growth. Not next year, the year after, but over a 10-year period. Do those all three things, we'll get better growth.
Mark Zandi, Chief Economist for Moody's Analytics, thank you so much for having this important conversation with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's our 30 Issues election series for this week. Issue 17, the national debt is or is not a ticking time bomb. You can sign up for our free 30 Issues newsletter at wnyc.org/30issues. Once a week, we'll send you an update with links and some comments from me, wnyc.org/30issues, for our free 30 Issues newsletter. Next week, issue 18, the U.S. relationship with Israel.